This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
The night sky for August 2014. Well, at least in August, the nights draw in a bit. You don't have to stay up quite so late to see the heavens, and it actually does get quite dark around midnight or so. So what can we see? Well, looking towards the south, high in the sky, is that lovely region containing the constellations of Cygnus the Swan with its bright star Deneb, the small constellation Lyra with its bright star Vega, and down below in Aquila is the bright star Altair. Those three stars make up what is called the summer triangle. And if you take the major stars of Cygnus, they make up what's called the Northern Cross. There's a very sweet little constellation down to the lower left of Cygnus, a little up to the left of Altair, called Delphinus, the dolphin, which looks quite pretty. As you move over, a bit later in the evening, the great square of Pegasus is rising in the east. The four stars make up the square, the body of the winged horse, which is actually upside down as seen from northern latitudes. The top left-hand star of the square, called Alpharat, is actually Alpha Andromedae and is a way of leading you to the great nebula in Andromeda, M31. You simply start from Alpharat, you go one bright star to left, curve up to the right a bit to the second bright star, turn right through 90 degrees, go one further brightish star, and the same distance again, and you should see this fuzzy glow. High overhead, a little bit to the north, is the W-shaped constellation of Cassiopeia, and down towards the horizon is Perseus with its bright star Murfak. Between the two, along the plane of the Milky Way, is a rather lovely region which contains two close open clusters. It's called the Perseus Double Cluster. It's a lovely object to observe in a small telescope. Well, what about the planets? Well, Jupiter passed behind the Sun, that superior conjunction, on the 24th of July, so will not be visible in the early part of the month. However, by mid-month, should you have a low east-northeast horizon, one would just be able to see it before dawn at magnitude minus 1.8. By month's end, it will have risen to about 20 degrees above the horizon by 5:30 a.m. BST. So although hindered somewhat by the atmosphere, early risers should be able to spot the equatorial belts across the 32 arc second disk and the four Galilean satellites as they weave their way around it. From the 14th to the 21st of August, Jupiter will lie within about 4 degrees of Venus, and I'll come back to that in one of the highlights. It will appear far less bright than Venus, as, though larger, it's 7 times further away from the Sun and only receives about 2% of the sunlight that falls on Venus. Saturn is an evening planet. It lies in Libra near the wide double star Alpha Librae, falling in brightness a little from plus 0.5 to plus 0.6 magnitudes during the month. An hour after sunset, it will still be 20 degrees above the horizon, so we will be able to see the 17 arc second disk and the ring system around it, and perhaps, with a reasonable telescope, you'll be able to see Titan, its largest satellite. Well, Mercury will be so low above the horizon this month, it'll be very difficult to spot, even with binoculars or a telescope, so best not to try. What about Mars? As August begins, Mars lies midway between Spica and Alpha Librae, and moves eastwards from Virgo into Libra on the 10th. It shrinks from 7.7 to 7 arc seconds in angular diameter, and at the same time its brightness falls a little from magnitude plus 0.4 to plus 0.6. It's best observed as darkness falls, but given its low elevation, it's unlikely that any details will be seen on its salmon-pink surface. Finally, Venus. Venus rises in the east-northeast in the pre-dawn sky, but on the 1st is only about 20 degrees above the horizon by sunrise. On the far side of the Sun, its disk, now almost fully lit, drops in angular size from 10.7 to 10.2 arc seconds during the month. But at the same time, the percentage of the disk which is illuminated increases from 82 to 97%. As a result, the effective area reflecting the sun's light stays almost constant, so the magnitude stays at minus 3.8 throughout the month. Venus moves from Gemini on the 11th to join Jupiter in Cancer before moving into Leo on the 27th. But by then, it'll only be about 14 degrees above the horizon at sunrise. Well, what highlights have we to look for this month? Well, on the night sky page of the Jodrell Bank website, you'll find a chart to show you how to find the globular cluster in Hercules and the double-double star in Lyra. This, to binoculars, looks like a double star, but under good seeing conditions with a telescope, each of those stars is seen to be itself double. August is also a good month to observe Neptune with a small telescope. It comes into opposition, which is when it's nearest to the Earth, on the 29th of August, so it will be seen quite well both this month and next. Its magnitude is about plus 7.9, so it's easily spotted in binoculars lying in the constellation of Aquarius, and the chart on the night sky page shows you where to look. It rises to an elevation of about 27 degrees when it's due south. If you've got a telescope of 8 inches or more in aperture and a dark, transparent night, you may well even be possible to spot its moon, Titan. August the 3rd, about an hour after sunset, we have the Moon, Mars and Saturn. So looking southwest, you should be able to spot the Moon lying between Mars at magnitude plus 0.4 to its lower right, and Saturn, magnitude plus 0.5 to its upper left. Given a low horizon in the southwest, you may also spot Spica in Virgo, down to the right of Mars. On August the 10th, the Moon is closest to the Earth as it can get, and that point is at 7 p.m. that evening. However, it is also at full moon just 9 minutes later. It actually rises at 8:15 on the 10th. So that is as big an angular size essentially that we can ever see at full moon. And it's called a mega moon or a super moon. In fact, compared to when the moon is furthest away from us at full moon, the diameter is 12% bigger. And that makes quite a difference in the overall area and hence in the brightness. So I do hope it's clear that night. It'll be a lovely thing to see. On the mornings of the 12th and 13th of August, it might be worth having a look out for the Perseid meteor shower. Though sadly, this year the moon will be just past full, so its light will wash out the fainter meteors. But let's say within a half-hour period, you should still see half a dozen or more. The Perseid meters are produced by debris from the comet Swift-Tuttle, and the peak is actually around midday on the 12th, so you've actually got a good chance to see it either on the 12th or the 13th. On August the 18th, before dawn, Venus and Jupiter will appear in the eastern sky just 12 arc minutes apart. That is pretty close. And they'll also lie just a couple of degrees below M44, an open cluster in Cancer, often called Praesepe. So that'll be a lovely thing to look for. Venus will be at magnitude minus 3.8, and it'll be up a little and a bit to the left of Jupiter, shining at magnitude minus 1.8. Around 5 a.m, they will be just 5 degrees above the horizon, so a low horizon with pretty transparent skies will be needed. But if so, a pair of binoculars will see all three objects in one field, and it will make a great imaging opportunity. On August the 23rd, again about an hour before sunrise, you can spot Venus, Jupiter, and a waning thin crescent moon. You'll need a good low eastern horizon, though. I sometimes include on the night sky page things to observe on the moon, giving the dates when they're best seen, which is when the terminator lies fairly close, making the shadows longest. And on August the 4th and the 17th, it's possible to see well what is called the straight wall. It's actually a gentle scarp, and Sir Patrick Moore has said, "Neither is it a wall, nor is it straight." Finally, I might just mention the Cambridge University Press have just published my book called An Amateur's Guide to Observing and Imaging the Heavens. If you look it up, you'll find some very nice reviews, one by Stephen James O'Meara, who is certainly one of the world's greatest visual observers, and a second by Damien Peach, who is undoubtedly the world's best planetary imager. They both think it's okay, so perhaps it's all right. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for that, Ian. And now for the Southern Hemisphere, here's Claire Bretherton.
Kia ora and welcome to the August Jodcast from Carter Observatory in Wellington, New Zealand. This month sees Scorpius and Sagittarius high overhead in our evening sky. Scorpius is our winter constellation and is easy to spot with the orange star Antares, which marks his heart, lying just east of the zenith. A curve of bright stars stretches out towards the right of this, forming his tail. Antares is a red supergiant star with a radius more than 800 times that of the Sun. If it were placed at the centre of our solar system, its surface would lie between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. The name Antares means rival of Mars, because of its distinctive colour. This tells us that it is a cooler star than our Sun, at around 3,500 Kelvin. Here in New Zealand, we don't have Scorpius, however, so we see this group of stars as something a little more familiar here in the southern Pacific. To Maori, this group of stars is known as Te Mato o Maui, the fishhook of Maui. Maui used this hook to pull up a great fish out of the ocean, which became the North Island of New Zealand, Te Ika Maui. The red star is now known as Rehua and represents a drop of blood that Maui took from his nose to use as bait. Below Scorpius is an upside-down teapot shape formed from the brightest stars in Sagittarius. The broadest and brightest part of the Milky Way lies towards Scorpius and Sagittarius high in our eastern evening sky. We are very lucky here in the Southern Hemisphere that we look more towards the centre of our galaxy, providing a whole assortment of stunning nebulae and star clusters to observe. Lying along the tail of the Scorpion is NGC 6231, a bright cluster of stars which looks like a small comet. Estimated to be only 3.2 million years old and nearly 6,000 light-years away, if the cluster was placed at the same distance as the Pleiades, then some of its stars would be amongst the brightest in the night-time sky. About halfway between the Scorpion's sting and the spout of the teapot is M7. This is an open cluster of stars, easily visible to the naked eye, and a lovely sight through a good pair of binoculars. M7 is thought to be around 980 light-years away and around 200 million years old, still pretty young in astronomical terms. Nearby and somewhat fainter, the Butterfly Cluster, or M6, is also well worth a look in binoculars. To the left of the teapot spout, and just about visible to the naked eye, is the Lagoon Nebula, or M8. This is a huge cloud of interstellar gas and dust where new stars are being formed. M8 is a great example of an H2 region, where the UV radiation from hot young stars is ionizing the leftover hydrogen gas and causing it to glow. These emission nebulae often appear pink in color photographs. Along with the nearby Trifid Nebula M20, the Lagoon Nebula is a good target for binoculars or a small telescope. The Trifid Nebula is an interesting object to look at as it combines both an emission and reflection nebula with an open cluster of stars. It was discovered by Charles Messier in 1764 and is famed for the three-lobed appearance which earned it its name. Reflection nebulae glow by reflecting and scattering light from the nearby stars. They often appear blue in colour as the scattering of blue light is more effective than that of red light. There are also a number of globular clusters in this part of the sky. These are large spherical clusters containing hundreds of thousands of ancient stars, dating back more than 12 billion years. Over 150 are found in the halo of the Milky Way, in the outskirts of our galaxy. The distribution of these clusters provided early evidence of the scale of the Milky Way and our position within it. The brightest globular cluster is M4, and this is also one of the easiest to find, lying just 1.3 degrees west of Antares. Appearing as a small fuzzy ball in binoculars or small telescopes, a slightly larger telescope will begin to pick out individual stars. Also in this region, near the top of the teapot, is M22. This was the first globular cluster ever discovered in 1665, and at just 10,000 light-years away, it is also one of the closest, making it well worth a look. From its bright centre in Sagittarius, the Milky Way stretches out east to west in our early evening. Along this path, we find the majority of the bright stars in our night-time sky. In the north, just to the left of the Milky Way, is Vega, the fifth brightest star in the sky. Vega is about 25 light-years away and 50 times brighter than the Sun. It forms part of the constellation of Lyra, the lyre or harp. Opposite, in the southern sky, the second brightest star, Canopus, can be found in the constellation of Carina. This star is 310 light-years away and 15,000 times brighter than the Sun. To Maori in Aotearoa, New Zealand, this star is Atutahi or Aotahi, which means to stand alone. Running back along the Milky Way towards Scorpius, we first pass the False and Diamond Crosses before arriving at Crux, the Southern Cross. The smallest of the 88 official constellations, Crux has become an icon of the southern sky. It has the appearance of a diamond kite shape of four bright stars, along with a fifth fainter star. To Maori, it is known as Te Punga, the anchor of Tamariti's waka. Alpha Crucis is the 12th brightest star in the sky, and it appears to the unaided eye as a single star of magnitude 0.9. But small telescopes reveal it is in fact a double star with blue-white components of magnitudes 1.4 and 1.9. Nearby is NGC 4755, an open cluster of stars also known as the Jewel Box, named from Sir John Herschel's vivid description of the cluster as a casket of variously coloured precious stones. The cluster is about 6,500 light-years away and is rich and bright, with the stars showing delicate colours accentuated by an orange-red supergiant. It can easily be seen with the naked eye, but binoculars and telescopes will reveal much more detail. Just to one side is a dark patch known as the Coalsack Nebula. This is a cloud of interstellar dust and gas some 700 light-years away. It is so thick and dense that it obscures the light from more distant stars, appearing as a darkened area against the bright backdrop of the Milky Way. To Maori, it's known as Te Patiki, or the Flounder. Towards the east of Crux are the two bright pointer stars, Alpha and Beta Centauri, marking the front hooves of Centaurus, the centaur. When we look away from the path of the Milky Way, the brightness and number of stars drops off rapidly. Mars and Saturn sit near to Spica, the brightest star in Virgo this month, with the orange star Arcturus below. The differences in colours are easily distinguished. Mars and Arcturus have a red-orange hue, while Spica is a brilliant blue-white and Saturn is yellow. Mars and Saturn will be at their closest on the 25th. Small telescopes will reveal Saturn's rings and largest moon Titan, looking like a small star around four ring diameters out from the planet. More powerful telescopes should reveal faint banding in the planet's atmosphere, along with gaps and variation in colour of the rings, as well as a number of smaller moons. This object, more than any other, will get a great response from first-time observers, as it really does look like it does in the pictures. Mars, on the other hand, will appear as a small red disk. It is getting fainter as we move away from it on our faster inner orbit. Also in the western sky is the planet Mercury. It will climb higher as the month progresses, setting 1.5 hours after the Sun by month's end. The crescent moon will be close by on the 27th. Brilliant Venus and Jupiter are in our morning sky and will be at their closest on the 18th, when there will be less than a full moon diameter between them. Thanks for listening into this month's Jodcast. Wishing you clear skies from the team here at Carter Observatory.